Glenn Dobbs was born in 1920 in McKinney, Texas. He was a successful running back and punter while playing for the high school in Frederick, Oklahoma. Following graduation, he enrolled at the University of Tulsa, where he played football in the 1940, 41, and 42 seasons. During his senior year in 1942, Dobbs led the Golden Hurricane to an undefeated 10-0 record. In addition to his running and passing skills, he was the nation's top collegiate punter in the 1942 season. Following his professional football career, Dobbs became head football coach at the University of Tulsa from 1961 to 1968. He was inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame as a player in 1980. At the time of his death in 2002, Dobbs was still regarded as the greatest football player in the University of Tulsa history. He died of cancer at the age of 82. Sports historian Wayne McCombs interviewed Glenn Dobbs April 24, 1997 for Voices of Sports Legends. Now heard on the oral history website, voicesofoklahoma.com.
Coach Dobbs, first tell us a little bit about your high school career in Frederick. You moved from Texas up to Oklahoma to Frederick, and tell us about the high school there.
We got to Frederick when I was in the fifth grade, and had no thought about playing football, although I loved to play pass touch and kicky-doodle and all those kid games when I was a kid in Texas, and I watched them play high school ball down there at Mundy, Texas, and same thing happened when we moved to Frederick, Oklahoma in the fifth grade. I was just a little bitty guy, and I loved to play out on the courthouse yard on Saturday, and we had a lot of fun, and I was always out at the ballpark. But I was in the band, and I stayed in the band for a long, long time. I didn't let her until I was senior in high school in football because, believe it or not, I'm 6'4 and about 210 now. I was 5'8 and 128 when I was in the 11th grade. Not a bad trumpet player, but no football. I went out for football, but I sat on the bench, and I didn't even make enough time to play to let her in football. My junior year, but I got to play, and I grew to 6'1", 165 the next year, and I was the only tailback, so I kind of had a cinch there playing single wing and short punt formation tailback, and I had learned how to kick on the courthouse yard there in Frederick as we played every Saturday morning. We had a couple of real good punters, and they taught us how to do that. And my dad played catch with us all the time in baseball, so it was natural to throw. And I just loved to play all the sports. In fact, my dad said, Wayne, that if I could figure out some sport to play, I never would work because I'd play anything to get out of working. And I guess that's about the best thing about being in Frederick, Oklahoma. We had Skivey Davis. I think he has a son who's a doctor here in Tulsa, Oklahoma right now. And I watched his teams. They were great, big, hard-running teams. And then the next year, he left, and Johnny Gregg, who had been a Frederick High School player, went to Hardin-Simmons as a pass catcher, came in as our head coach, and we started throwing the football a little bit. And as a matter of fact, and I'll tell you this, and you're the first to hear it, not many people know, they thought Colonel Blake invented the wide receiver when he put the lonesome end out at West Point. Well, we started playing with a wide receiver in 1938 named Cotton Benson. He could run, he was fast. And I said, Coach, why do you put him off out there? Because we were just starting spring training, and he said, well, he won't block anyway. We'd just well to get him out there so you can throw at him. And that's how the wide receiver started in Frederick, Oklahoma, and the shotgun formation that they call in the pro ball nowadays, we call it spread formation and primarily used it to run. We'd suck the guys back rushing passer, then the fullback would knock one of them inside, and we'd run outside, and it was a run or pass deal, much like Jerry Rome did with a rollout pass with us later on. And so my Frederick High School deal was real good, and we only lost one game, and things worked out real good. The oil business had started a little bit in Frederick, and a fellow named Miller came down there from Gulf Oil here in Tulsa, and he got to telling Vic Hurt and Chet Benefield about me playing football and kicking it, and that's how I got acquainted with the Tulsa people, because the Oklahoma City paper didn't write about Frederick a whole lot like they don't write about Tulsa now. And we read everything and followed football through the Wichita Falls newspaper in Texas. And I was primarily recruited and talked to by TCU and SMU and the University of Texas. So I didn't know Tulsa was up here because the Daily Oklahoman or the Wichita Falls Record News never said anything about it. But thank heaven Mr. Miller got me acquainted with Coach Chet Benefield and Vic Hurt.
Who were some of the athletes you looked up to as a high school player in football and in other sports?
I think, Wayne, it was just as natural as could be because Sammy Ball was the hottest thing going in TCU that year. And I guess he was probably 4 or 5 years ahead of me. So I watched him and read the paper every day, the Wichita Falls Record News, every day to find out about Sammy Ball. And before that, it had been, and about the same time, a fellow named Bobby Wilson was a tailback and passer over at SMU. Now, they were my favorite because I had been born in McKinney, Texas, just outside of Dallas, and I loved that little Mustang pony that the SMU had and the red and blue colors, and I thought, well, I'll play at SMU. But we couldn't help watching Sammy Ball, and then the next year Davey O'Brien took over, and they covered the sports page. So every time we lined up to play on Saturday morning, well, I was Sammy Ball from TCU, and we were throwing the football and kicking it all over the lot.
What was your decision that made you come to the University of Tulsa?
Economic, pure and simple. We were at SMU, and I had gone down to visit some relatives with my mother and dad, and we went out to see Matty Bell at SMU, and I had a job coming up with Magnolia Oil Company. They had that big red horse on top of their building down there in Dallas, and Mr. Bell got me a job with the Magnolia Oil Company as a kind of a roustabout out in the oil field for $145 a month. And, of course, back in 1938, when I was looking around to become a freshman in 39, that was an awful lot of money. So I said, well, good, I want to go to SMU because that's where I wanted to play anyway. They got that fine little mascot. And I had talked to Coach Benefield about coming to Tulsa, and he called me on Saturday. I was in Dallas going to work for them on a Monday, and he said, well, I thought you were coming here to Tulsa. And I said, well, sir, they offered me a job for $145 a month starting Monday, and I'm going to go to work for them. He said, I will get you a job that will pay you twice that much for $290 a month, Wayne. When I told my dad that, he was 6 feet and 230. He said, you tell him you got a fullback that has got 3-4 years eligibility left and I've never played a game of football, but I'll come and block for that kind of money. But anyway, it all worked out, and I said, well, fine. I talked to my dad, and Tulsa needed a tailback at that time, and he said, well, son, you want to play, and they don't have a tailback coming back your sophomore year. Well, it sounds good to me. So I said, fine, I'm going to go to Tulsa. Called Coach Benefield back, and I got on a train that night, Saturday night, and I landed in Tulsa the next morning, about 7 o'clock, and they picked me up, and he said, now you're going to Odessa, Texas. He introduced me to the head man of the Arrow Drilling Company, and Monday morning, I went to work on a drilling rig. Now, Coach Benefield was smart, and I liked him, and all the boys played for him because they liked him, and he was a man's man and a player's coach, but he was very strict. He said, now, I'll get you this job, but if you lose it, I won't get you another. Well, that suited me. I was raised that way. You earn whatever you get, you got to earn it. So I got there, and I said, oh, boy, this is good. I'm going to make $290 out on a drilling rig. Well, I did, but I worked 2 towers. I worked 16 hours a day, and Coach Benefield, to the day he died, would tell me about my high-paying job out there. And, of course, roughnecking wasn't all that tough because when you were not going in or out of the hole, it wasn't all that tough, just kind of cleaning up out and around. But for a young kid just out of high school, 16 hours sitting in one place was a lot.
When you came to Tulsa and went to the University of Tulsa, how different was the school at that time? Of course, Skelly Stadium was there in a much smaller capacity, but what was it like being a freshman at TU in the fall of 39?
Well, the high school stadium, they doubled it while we were there playing. my last year, we got hot and started winning and everything, and they doubled that stadium, and Tulsa looked like it was just about ready to get doubled up if we did good, because they had a lot of room. It only had about 12,000 seats, but it was brand new, I think about 4 years old at the time. And if you'll remember, Wayne, from reading back, crowds were not so big in those days. TV and radio was not all that hot, so the crowds weren't that big.
Back in the 30s and 40s, a big crowd was 15,000 people at Oklahoma State, Tulsa, OU. 15,000 was a large, large crowd.
Yeah, we'd have almost a full house when I was on the varsity out there at TU. It might be almost full, but that's all we thought about. Well, we darn near sold out, and we didn't pay all that much attention to it. Pro football was not that hot in those days, and nobody really thought much about going to play pro football until after World War II. So it wasn't that big a deal, and Tulsa Stadium was new, and we were playing SMU, we were playing TCU, we were playing Texas A&M, we were playing Oklahoma A&M. We were playing a lot of those schools that we knew about, and even though the publicity was not so big as it is today, that schedule today would fill Skelly Stadium all the time because people want to see those named teams, and they had enough of them on there that it made it attractive, and we had good competition until the last year. So all in all, it was the new stadium and the economic situation. The old depression wasn't all the way over at that time, and I came to Tulsa, and it was great, and they got a bunch of high school guys from Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. And that was the first time in a long time that they had all high school boys on their freshman team. So we gelled together with Coach Benefield and Coach Franca, and it worked out beautifully.
Tell us about that special person you met at the University of Tulsa that has been with you all these years.
Well, that was June Manchester, and that was the biggest and the best thing that ever happened to me or anybody else as far as that goes. All the guys and gals that we knew, and they met each other at the University of Tulsa. That was the best thing for all of us, because as I look back, Wayne, nearly all of the guys and gals, the ones that are not gone now, we're getting old, but June and I have been married 55 years, and I'll tell you, it's just this simple. When I represented the University of Tulsa, June went with me everywhere that I went, out of town, in town, no matter where we went. And especially if there was a cocktail party or anything like that, she drove the car. And I would not misrepresent the University of Tulsa in any way, shape, or form. And as a player, I told our guys, now we can't wear our T-shirts or our jackets, letter jackets, or anything like that if we're going to the honky-tonk tonight to dance or to Bob Wills' place to dance. And June Manchester is something else, and she raised our two sons the way we were both raised, strict, loving, tough, disciplined-type parents, and very, very, very loving parents. But also they knew what was what and that it had to be done, and she raised our boys that way while I coached football.
Now, your first year playing football at TU was 1940, and you opened up the season against Washburn, Kansas, and at Skelly Stadium, and defeated them. And then you went to San Antonio. You played Texas A&M, the opening of the ballpark there in San Antonio. They just closed after a few years. Tell us what it was like playing in front of, at that time, a record crowd. You had 20,000 people there. Little old bitty TU against Texas A&M there in San Antonio. What was that game like?
Well, Texas A&M had three All-Americans. They had John Kimbrough at fullback, and Dick Todd was their quarterback, and then they had a guard that was out of this world, too. I can't think of his name right now, but for Tulsa to go down and open that stadium was just really one of the finest things that could happen. And unfortunately, our coach went on a Monday before that game, went to a Missouri Valley Conference meeting. And that's another reason I never cared much for the Missouri Valley Conference. There they are having a meeting on a Monday before we're playing Texas A&M. And the assistant coaches were put in charge. Well, we had some of the toughest, roughest coaches you ever saw. Wickersham was a blocking back at TU, and now he's coaching the backs. And Bocce Cook, an All-American guard from Baylor, was coaching the line. And these guys decided that this day the backs were going to tackle the linemen. Well, the first rattle out of the box, I come up 6 foot four and about 190, 95 maybe, and I'm the tailback for Tulsa, and we're going to play and throw the football a little. And I'm tackling Wayne Holt, 5 foot nine and 255 pounds, and we were 10 yards apart. Well, he knocked my shoulder clear down to my ankles, and on my right shoulder. And I mean, Wayne, it hurt. It's about as hurt and painful an injury as I ever had, and I could not throw the rest of that week. I threw one pass that game, and that was it. The rest of the time we spent the ball, or spent the time chasing my punts down to the end of the field, and they're running back, running them back about as far as I kicked them, and they beat us pretty good. So it was not a happy time, but it was good to tie in with that company.
Yeah. In 1940, TU went 7-3, had a good year. You defeated Oklahoma State at Skelly Stadium, and then had a tough ball game with Arkansas on Thanksgiving Day, 1940. The place was oversold. It only held 12,000, but all the records I've seen of that game, there was 15,000 people, and they couldn't get everybody in the ballpark. And you played a tough game with Arkansas, and you lost 27-21. What was that like, your first Thanksgiving Day game playing at Skelly Stadium, a record crowd, and just a sophomore against a named team like Arkansas?
It was terrific. My high school coach came up to watch the game, and my mother and father were out there, and a lot of people that I knew from around Oklahoma, having played in the All-State games. Well, I knew a lot of the former high school players that were in this area. So a lot of people were there that I knew, and I was really excited about it. And we had probably the greatest broken field runner that I've ever seen before or since in N.A. Keithley. And he and I alternated a lot of times. And in the Arkansas game, when he would come in, I would move to the wing back. And it wasn't too exciting about running the football down Arkansas's throat. They were bigger and stronger than we were, and it just wasn't all that good. But we were not doing as well as we would have liked, and so I would move over to wingback when N.A. came in, and I would block as good as I could for N.A., and we tried to run and so forth, but he would generally throw me the ball about every fourth or fifth time because I was tall and he was short and he could see over the line. Well, we got down there and we're trying to win the game, and Red Hickey, later a 49er coach, was playing left defensive end, and every time I tried to get out of the backfield, he just grabbed me and held me. Well, the second time he did that, I said, "Now, Red, the next time you do that, my elbow's going to slip and hit you right across the face." Well, I did, and he did. And then he grabbed me as we both started to fall, and I couldn't get out. So N.A. ran a little bit, got down there. Then the next time we got down there, he was going to throw me a pass, and the big old basketball player that played for Arkansas in those days and was in the secondary, and he tackled me in the end zone, and the ball flew over our head. But we still had a chance, and later in the ball game, I threw a pass to a fella, Elston Campbell, in the end zone. And just as he was catching the football, he got tackled and dropped the darn thing, and we lost it. But it was a big thrill, and everybody enjoyed it, and it brought the people back next year.
Well, I thought those kind of calls we only got over in Fayetteville all those years.
Well, it was the same because the officials were from the Southwest Conference, and all the other officials were trying to move out of the Missouri Valley into the Southwest Conference, so they let the Southwest Conference officials run the ball game.
1940 comes to a close, and Chet Benefield moves on from the University of Tulsa. He'd been a star player there, basketball coach, football coach. And Henry Franca comes in as the head coach of the University of Tulsa as we start 1941. How did he come to get the position at TU?
His record, he had been with Mr. Morrison at Vanderbilt, and I believe they were back at Temple at that time. And Coach Franca had an outstanding record as a high school coach in Greenville, Texas. He had little kids from the time they were big enough to put a football suit on in Greenville, He had the football boys running the varsity, high school varsity plays all the way up, and he had a tremendous record as a high school coach. And Coach Morrison had been at SMU, and then he went to Vanderbilt, and he'd had three or four big jobs, and then was the head man at Temple. And when Tulsa decided to hunt somebody, why, they got in touch and found out about Coach Franca being from the Southwest, and so they all went for him and brought him in. I guess, as an expert from out of town with a briefcase, why they thought that would make the difference. And
they still do.
Yeah, and he was an excellent, excellent football coach, but he was entirely different than Coach Benefield. And for the first few games our junior year, it was a little bit different. He was quite a disciplinarian, and we'd run a play maybe 50 to 100 times, and if we didn't do it just right, we'd run it again before we ever put it in a ball game. He was that decisive about way to do it. He'd hook Sax Judd at 10 yards on the hash mark. Mm-hmm. Well, Sax would go down and put his right foot on the hash mark and turn around, and the ball would be there, and he'd say, no, Glenn, I want you to throw the ball before he turns around, and if he doesn't look, it'll hit him in the face. Well, I threw it quicker. Sax didn't turn, and it hit him in the face. And he'd say, no, Sykes, I mean for you to put both feet on that hash mark, not the left foot, not the right foot. I want both feet on the hash mark. Well, that's why we got to throw and catch pretty good, and Sachs learned how because the ball hit him in the face a time or two. And
no face guards then.
No, we didn't have those. But Sachs was the greatest catcher of a football I've ever seen in my life, and it would have been a shame if he could have run fast. Mm-hmm. But he always said he was a little too tired to run fast, but he could catch that football.
So is this the first you've seen in your football career where you would actually throw the ball before the player would get to the position? You would throw to the spot, and then it was the receiver's job to get there.
Right. This is the thing they all make such a big deal about today. And there again, we started back there, and that was 1941 with Coach Franca. And in high school, well, I had thrown the ball just boom down there, and if they were open, why, they'd try to run under it, or I'd try to hit them and so forth. And the main thing my high school coach did, he said, now you know all about the defense, don't you? And I said, well, not really. And he said, well, you know, well, the defense wears red shirts tomorrow. And I said, oh yeah. And he said, well, don't throw it to them. 2 years later, that reading of the defense, I had only one pass intercepted in 2 years of high school football, and the same thing came along with Coach Franca. He mm-hmm. says, we do not throw the ball to the other folks. They got on different colored shirts, Glenn. Don't throw it to the different colored shirts. Well, all my life, I was fortunate, and I didn't have a lot of passes intercepted, and it was due to those kind of coaches and Coach Benefield getting us together to start with. And mm-hmm. we learned things, and we did them the way the coach wanted it done. Said you lay the football down in the end zone and turn around and kind of nod your head to the official to say we'll be back and get another one in a little while. No show, walk in the huddle, walk out of the huddle, and then explode on the snap of the ball. Mm-hmm. But no showboat.
That's a contrast to some of the players today. In 41, you open up, have a tough game against a highly rated Texas Christian and down at TCU and only lose 6-0. You pick up a couple of wins in the Missouri Valley, and then you've got Oklahoma State in Stillwater. This is in October of 41, and you shut them out. Now, you played defense. A lot of people forget that you were also playing defense, and you led TU in interceptions a couple of years. But in 41, you shut out Oklahoma State 16-0, and that was the first shutout you had against Oklahoma A&M at that time. Was that a pivotal game? Was that maybe the game where you guys thought you could actually go to a bowl game?
I don't think any of us thought about a bowl game, really, Wayne. We may have. I just don't remember. But mm-hmm. the big deal was Oklahoma A&M. All of the guys met each other during the high school season or lucky enough to play in the high school all-star game when they had it in Oklahoma City, and we lived in a gymnasium, and we were all together. And we were acquainted with all the players at Oklahoma A&M, and they were acquainted with us. Well, naturally, the rivalry was there, and away we went. And we were really thrilled because if I had gone other than Tulsa, I would have gone to Oklahoma A&M on account of Mr. Lookabaugh. And he was a nice man, and I really liked him, and I wanted to go there prior to getting hooked up with SMU and Tulsa. But he made a mistake. He said, well, we're going to give your mother a laundry box with our name on one side and yours on the other, and you can send your dirty clothes home, and your mother can do your laundry and then send it back to you. And my mother looked at Mr. Lookabaugh, and she said, Mr. Lookabaugh, I don't do his laundry now, and I'm not going to do it so he can go to your school. If you can't afford to pay for his laundry, he's not coming to Oklahoma A&M. And that was the fun part of it as far as our family was concerned. But the battle was because of Oklahoma kids wanting to beat Oklahoma kids at Oklahoma A&M, and they were our number one opponent. They really were.
Well, you had some tough games with them during the 40s, and then when you were a coach. We come now to the Thanksgiving Day game again in 1941, and the year before you had 3,000 people standing room only, and this year you have 5,000. You have a crowd of over 17,000 fans in a place that holds 12,000, and you play the Arkansas Razorbacks again. And again, it was just another one of those tight games, losing 13-6. Was that a tough game to take? Did you know after you... did you think going into that game with Arkansas, if you win, you might get a bowl game? Was there that much anticipation of it back in those days?
That one, our junior year, we kind of thought maybe we might get involved in a bowl game. Not as much as nowadays, but there had been a little bit of a tremble about maybe we could get a bowl game, and that one really let us down because we thought we had a real good football team, and we were... a pretty good size football team, unlike the next year when we were small. We were about as big as they were, and we didn't have the speed that we needed, but we just couldn't quite get over the hump. We just didn't get things to work. Just like down at TCU, that first game Coach Frank had coached, now that was a combination of his fault and my fault. He didn't know us well enough to know that I didn't have any business playing against the wind down at TCU, and he did not realize that N.A. Keithley was the greatest running back, broken field runner, in the country that year. And of all things, he played me throwing and kicking into the wind both quarters, and N.A. was running with the wind. Well, now, he was so short that the wind wouldn't have bothered him either way, but... Really, we blew that ball game because later on, kicking into the wind, I got back to kick one, and I kicked that ball for a minus 6 yards. I turned it to put the point down so I could try to kick it low, and I dropped the ball a little too high, and the wind moved it over, and I just darn near missed it, and I finally caught the darn thing for a loss of 6 yards, and that's how they got their 6 points. The Arkansas game was a little tougher, and... I just don't remember a lot of the little details there, but it was just one of those games where we, like the basketball shooters, they were hitting the rim and not the net. It just didn't work out.
Mm-hmm. When did you get the word that you were going to be invited to the Sun Bowl to play Texas Tech? Was it a quite an honor to play against us? You wanted to play against a Southwest team, didn't you? And here you go against Texas Tech. What was it like to be on the team? To be in the very first bowl game at the University of Tulsa. And back in 1941, there was only about four or five, so you were in the top 10 that year. What type of feeling was that to come from Frederick to make the top 10 of collegiate football?
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Strangely, only us young guys wanted to play in the bowl game. We had all gotten jobs down at the post office when school was just about out for Christmas. And everybody that got on down there, we were going to work 12, 14 hours a day, whatever it took. And the postmaster was a TU booster, and he hired all of us that wanted to work, and all of us did, and we could. And strangely, none of us had to worry about our grades out at the University of Tulsa because we were not bust outs or whatever. And everybody was good students and had good records in the back. So if we needed to miss a day or two of school, we could. And we could make an awful lot of money. And some of the older players, the seniors, were not interested in going to a bowl game in El Paso, Texas at all. In fact, we had to have a meeting and really lobby hard and work hard and talk to those us young guys, talking to those old seniors about, well, this will be a thrill. This will start Tulsa in the bowl games, and we need to go, and we need to play, and we can win a trophy. And we finally won by just a few votes, and some of us were worried about how we would come out if everybody wasn't 100%. But we got down there, and the travel was bad on account of the war and this, that, and the other. But we finally got in a hotel. Some of us slept on cots, and some slept in the lobby and all that. But we were in the big time. And Texas Tech had led the nation in pass defense, as a matter of fact. And they were very good defensively all the way around. They had a big guy named Irons that played linebacker. He was about 6 foot three or four and about 190 pounds. But, oh, my goodness, he could run and he could hit people. And we had a heck of a time with them. And we completed quite a few passes. And finally, Sax Judd caught a hook pass. And he made a fake one way and turned around, went the other way, and made a touchdown, and we won the football game. And
well, you threw the pass. It was 32 yards. It was late in the fourth quarter, and it was 0-0 game, and then TU pulled it out 6-0.
It was amazing how we stayed in the game with them. We would shift over to formation left, single wing left, and I would run the off-tackle play and scramble or fall for 2 or 3 yards because I was tall. And that big old linebacker would hit me, but we could at least get over there and block. And my brother was a great blocker at fullback, and Joe Gibson and Dewey Erickson were great blockers at halfback or at quarterback, blocking back. And then we had Roy Stewart and a kid from Hollis, Brown Admiral.
Well, in that game with TCU, they led the nation in pass defense, but you threw for 239 yards and kind of kept them off balance and threw the touchdown pass for the victory. Now, there weren't a whole lot of TU fans down there. From what I understand, there was a little over 12,000 people down there, and over 11,000 of them were pulling for the Red Raiders. Was that tough to actually play in a game that would really be considered a home game for Texas Tech?
Not really, Wayne. That was one thing that never bothered us. We were all from little small towns, and the big crowd and all that, it was just a football game. And we all loved to play. Everybody liked to play, and it wasn't to make All-American or the Heisman Trophy. We didn't even know what the Heisman Trophy was. In fact, I honestly believe that had we known what it was, I really believe that Coach Franca and B.A. Bridgewater would have gotten the Heisman Trophy for me. Mm-hmm. I really believe that because our statistics were so.
Now, B.A. Bridgewater was the editor of the sportsman of the Tulsa World.
Right, he was, and as I told you later on, he's the guy that really did all of the sports and pushing it out to his cohorts all across the nation. Mm-hmm. And he was well-known and highly respected as a sports writer all over the United States, not just Tulsa, not just Oklahoma. He could have done it. Mm-hmm. But in this part of the country, if you other people will think about it, I know that Heisman was a trainer. And mm-hmm. he was actually working as a trainer in New York, I think, when they decided they were going to honor him because he was such a fine man. And the Heisman Trophy probably was not over 2, 3, or 4 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. And very frankly, and I really believe this, not because of me, but because of Franca and Bridgewater. Mm-hmm. I believe with our record, I probably would have won the thing if we'd have known what it was. Because Franca told me the year before my senior year, he said, "Now, son, you're going to be an All-American football player next year. But here's what you're going to do." And he said, "You're going to line up and you're going to run off tackle until I tell you to stop." And I said, "Well, Coach, we do pretty good throwing the ball." And he says, "You're going to run the football. And then we will throw when we get ready, and they'll be looking for you to run."
Yeah.
But he said, "If you can't run," and I ran like a big wild turkey with my head up, trying to figure out a way to keep from getting hit too hard or some silly thing like that. But or looking to throw a pass before I got to the line of scrimmage. But I ran off tackle that spring until my nose bled and my thighs hurt. But I learned how to plant my foot and make a couple or 3 yards maybe, and then a lot of times later on I could throw that jump pass as I got to the line of scrimmage or hold it and run outside and throw it out there. But Coach Franca did that, and our team, oh, how they could block. They were good pass protectors.
Tell us about some of those outstanding players you played with. I'm going to mention several, and you kind of tell us a little bit about them. Clyde Goodnight.
Clyde Goodnight was a big old awkward kid from down in Texas. Coach Franca had picked up a bunch of them from that part of the country to come up there because he was well known in that part. He was an honor student. He was, you would not have picked him to be a football player. He was not a muscular type person, rather as a kind of a teenager, big kid who was going to grow up and be big, but he could catch the football. Unfortunately, like so many of us, he couldn't run real fast, but you could depend on him not to bust a signal and to give you 100% effort. That was Nip Goodnight. He became a doctor, very successful in his home area, and we talked to him last year.
What about Cal Purdon?
Cal Purdon was an all-state tailback from Augusta, Kansas. He was the first guy that I met at Tulsa. We came, for some reason, they wanted us to come. Oh, I know. He was all-state tailback in Kansas, and I was an all-state tailback in Oklahoma. And Coach Benefield wanted us there early to get some pictures and to meet some other people and so forth and do a little public relations and hopefully get people to talking about buying season tickets. So that's how I met Cal. Cal was about 6 foot one and a half or two, and he would knock your head into next week. Oh, he was tough. His hands were very strong and not really big, so he was not as adept at passing the football as he was running and kicking. He could run over anybody, anytime, and he could catch the football, strangely, with hard hands and strong hands that were not real supple and so forth, and he ran as a tailback in high school, and so they put him at wingback, and when we ran the reverse, he ran in there hard, and he was a fine football player and a great tackler on defense. He and I were fraternity brothers, and although I played tailback and he moved over to wingback instead of tailback, we were friends all the way, and if I went out of the game, he'd come in to punt. And if he needed to play tailback, he could do anything and played defense. He and my brother played defense back there like crazy.
You talked about the line. Tell us about Ellis Jones and the courage he had.
I guess he was probably one of the most versatile linemen that I've ever seen. They put me with him when he came up here in junior college. And from junior college, they put me with him at spring training to kind of get him used to all the guys and everything and get him acquainted around the campus, and wasn't too hard because it didn't have over four or five buildings around the whole place and about 700 students, so it wasn't too difficult there. But the first day of practice, why, I didn't know exactly what to do, and I thought, well, we're getting ready to tie our shoes, and I said, want me to tie your shoes for you? And he said, oh, no, I can handle it. And he says, matter of fact, why don't we run a race about tying our shoes? Well, here I'm.
Now, for some people who might not know, Ellis Jones only had one arm.
Right.
He'd lost it in a farming, was it a farming accident, I believe?
Well, it was on a farm, yes, where they lived. But I believe, as I remember, that he fell out of a tree and broke it about halfway from the elbow up to the shoulder and gangrene and whatever set in, and he lost it in the middle of the bicep area. So he didn't have fingers or wrists or anything to help him with on that side, but I said, you want to run a race to tie shoes? And he said, oh, yeah. And he kind of laughed, and he was a very pleasant fellow. And another one of those guys that was not all muscled up, he was just a good, smooth-looking 185 pounds. And he could run fast, one of our few speed guys. And we ran that race, and he tied his shoes before I tied mine. So I didn't help him anymore, and he didn't need any help because he was so fast. He could pull out of that line, and he would put his hand down on that one side to turn the corner, and he would go through. Along with that, that makes me think of Wayne Holt, about 5'9 and 240 or 50. I never could get Wayne to turn up the hole and turn up the field when we ran the off-tackle play. And finally, one day, after getting hit about four or five times on that play, I said, Wayne, why don't you turn up the field? I can't run out there and go out of bounds and make any yards. He said, dog boy, he says, when you're as fat as I am and you're running downhill in one direction, it ain't too easy to go another way. And that was the truth. He just flat was so big and slow that he got up ahead of steam going to the sideline and he couldn't turn. And he was something.
What about Clyde LaFleur? What he was quarterback, played just about every offensive backfield position, and just a real leader, wasn't he?
He was everything that every mother, dad, and football coach wants. He was absolutely the only thing. Here again, he was not fast. But if he had been, it would have been illegal because he was such a fine person. He was an honor student all the way. He was my pledge son in a fraternity. And at the end of 9 weeks, he asked me if I'd go with him to the dean of the engineering school and find out why he made the grade he made. And I said, sure, I'll go with you. And I knew Dean Langenheim real well, and we'll talk to him. We get over about halfway, and we're in front of the library, and I said, by the way, what grade did you make? And he said, I made an A-. I said, we're going to go talk to the engineering school dean about an A-. He said, yeah, I don't know why I didn't make straight A on that thing. But he was that good a student, and he worried about making good grades. And he was a great football player. He ran punts back. He outslowed them when he was running the punts back. But he was good. He did it in professional football, too. He was a great
He played a lot of years in pro football.
Yeah, he went to Detroit as a professional.
Yeah. This brings us to 1942. The Hurricane have probably their best season in school history. The first six games you play in 1942, you shut out your opponents. How did you do that? You shut out six teams in a row. Well, seven if you count the Texas Tech game the year before. You shut out seven consecutive teams.
I would say that probably the main thing was what I mentioned earlier about Coach Franca. Discipline and doing over and over and over what we knew had to be done if we were to succeed, because, as I said, we were not speed demons at all. But if one receiver did one thing, then I would be the safety man, we'll say. I knew what I had to do. And the other backs knew what they had to do. If somebody came and took Cal Purdon at right halfback and made him do a certain thing, then as a safety man, I did this, and the linebacker did that. And, I mean, there wasn't a mistake made. You had to play and make your defense. And we did not have a situation where some turkey caught a pass and there was nobody within 30 yards of him at all. Mm-hmm. We were with our men. We didn't knock them all down or intercept them all. I don't mean that. But we were in the vicinity of a pass catcher, and they didn't fool us about things like they had maybe done before or some other people did. Our coaches studied the film that we had, and we had that one projector, and when we used that as my sophomore year, when Bobby and I started coaching out there in 1955, that was still the only projector the University of Tulsa had, and they wore it out studying the film, and they taught us what to do. And that was Mike Milligan was the line coach, Buddy Brothers was the backfield coach, and Henry Franca was the head coach. And that's all they had, three men. And the other two listened when Coach Franca talked. Then when the backfield coach and the line coach were doing their individual work, Coach Franca would pick out two or three guys and do one little thing that he had to do. Mm-hmm. Now I understand they have about 10 football coaches, and I don't know what all they do out there.
Oklahoma State, your rival from the Missouri Valley in 1942. You play them at Skelly Stadium, another overflow crowd, and you have a good game against the Oklahoma State, or actually Oklahoma A&M at those days, and you gave them a pretty good knot on their head, 34-6. Was that, again, because of the you knew the players and knew they were in-state players? Was that a good feeling where you defeated some of your friends and people you see from time to time?
That was bragging rights, Wayne. We were going to see them, and this was going to be our last year because we were all going in the service. We knew that as soon as the season was over. We had all volunteered on the day after Pearl Harbor, but all of us had been told we would stay in school because they had so many people that volunteered and went into the service that they were going to let the college guys finish before they went into their varied branches of the service. And so that was it. We knew we were never going to see them, some of them again, and we were all primed and ready to go. And strangely, we had a little bit of a bad weather that day. And Coach Lookaball had primed his guys that I was not going to run that day at all. And we were going to do something else. And the next thing you knew, they thought we were going to run on second down and two, and we threw a pass. They thought we were going to pass on second down and eight or ten, and we ran. Everything clicked just absolutely perfect, and we were in a good mood anyway. And I remember throwing a pass to Sax Judd on a hook and go to the sideline. He caught the ball, and they got hit and slid out of bounds, and he looked up, and there was Mr. Lookaball, and he says, "Coach, you ought to be happy you're not out here. It's awful rough. These old Aggies are just knocking the tar out of us." And he got up and kind of smiled, and we went ahead and made a touchdown, and he came back by, and he says, "Boy, it's tough to score on these guys." And they really didn't have a chance because everything worked real good.
Then you beat a real good Baylor team, and you march through the season. And then you get an invitation to the Sugar Bowl. Now, that was something. The top bowl game, the Rose Bowl, Sugar Bowl, Orange Bowl, Cotton Bowl, and there you make it into the – you're ranked in the top 10, and you get to play Tennessee. What was the feeling like knowing you were going to go to New Orleans to the Sugar Bowl?
I would have to say that's probably like – the pros feel about the Super Bowl. We were so happy and thrilled and excited, and then to play Tennessee and General Nayland's old football team, even though Barnhart was coaching at the time, we were all excited and thrilled, and we just couldn't wait to get there because we knew that Tennessee was a running back outfit. They had a big fullback at about 230 or 235 named Fuson, and then they had a couple of little tailbacks that could really run with the football, and we knew that we could line up, and they were not going to score very much. And so we were going to throw the football and show them we could do that, and we really felt like that we could play and play with them, and not only that, we felt like we would win the football game, and it was horrible, the disappointment that came about after the game was over. We just didn't do what we intended to do, although we started out throwing the football and feeling each other out in the first quarter. And we did what we did, and we got to the other end of the field faster than Tennessee could because they were not going to run over us. We were going to be there in the vicinity when they got to the line of scrimmage. And as I said, guys like Cal Purdon and Bobby Dobbs and the other guys that played up there close to the line on defense, they could tackle with anybody. So we knew that we were going to do it. But after we made the touchdown, I threw a pass to Cal Purdon, and he scored with it and put us ahead. And after that, our first team backfield was never together again in the football game. Nobody to this day knows why. I don't know how it happened, but, one time, Wayne, I was back to punt, and N.A. Keithley was playing fullback instead of my brother, the best blocker on the team, and Clyde LaForce was at 165 pounds at blocking back, And he'd never played there before in his life. If he'd have been a good blocking back. But he had never played there before. And then Dell Taylor, who was about 165 or 70 pound by substitute back, he was in there as the other back. So we had three backs that I had never played with before in that condition. And I'm back to punt. And a big old boy named Dick Huffman, left tackle for Tennessee, picked Clyde LaForce, or N.A. Keithley, picked N.A. Keithley up and threw him across my leg and blocked a punt, and they got a safety just before the half. And as I remember, we lost a football game 2-1.
It was 14-7, and TU was driving late in the fourth quarter, and you got down to the Volunteers' 11-yard line, and then one of Keithley's passes was intercepted, or it might have been a different story. But still, you had a great year. 10-1, ranked fourth in the country, the highest the Hurricane has ever been ranked. And that must have been very satisfying, knowing that when you did leave the TU for the military, that you left TU football in a tremendous, tremendous shape.
We felt good about it, although, as I said before about other things that we've talked about, there was not nearly the emphasis on rankings all over the country as there is today, well, because of the media. Today, you talk about one little old thing, and it's all over the world the next day. And in our day, why, it was not that fast, and not that many people were that widely interested in it anyway.
Tell us a little bit. You left Tulsa, and you go to the military. Where did you serve?
I was in the Air Force. I wound up in a cadet training, but I had an eye problem and washed out of flight training. And they asked me what part I'd like to play on an aircraft. Now that I wasn't going to get to be a pilot, I said, I don't want to be in an airplane unless I'm driving that dude. And they kind of looked at me funny, and the other guy said, well, what'd you get in this thing for? And I said, because I'm married, and I want to make as much money as I can while I'm fighting in the war. And they thought that was kind of silly, and they sent me to Randolph Field, and from there I went to officer training school, and I came out and was assigned to the 2nd Air Force. And we later went to the Pacific on that.
When you got out of the service, where did you make your... Well, after that, you went to play pro football. Tell us about your days in Canada and with the American Football Conference, pro football after World War II.
I was very fortunate in that I played in the College All-Star game, a big game back there in our day. The College All-Stars would play the world champion professional team. And of all things, little old Tulsa boys were up there, and we played against Sammy Baugh and the Washington Redskins. Well, I had gotten to know Sammy Baugh through Lee Gentry, who played blocking back my sophomore year, and then he went on to play blocking back with the Washington Redskins. So Sammy and I talked before the game, and he always chewed tobacco, and he'd spit, and he'd say, now, son, I got a bad back. And he said, I tell you what, if you won't throw at me, I won't throw at you. He says, I understand you play back here, too. And I said, yes, sir, I play. And I really did. I said, sir, to the guy, because he just looked like he owned the whole world on that football field. And anyway, when we got the ball, I threw a pass out there, and we caught it right in front of him. And he looked up, and he made the tackle. He was a good defensive player. Anyway, we hit four or five passes and made a touchdown. The next time we passed each other, he laughed and spit, and he says, well, I see you're a typical Texan. He says, I'd have done the same damn thing if I'd have had the ball. I'd have thrown it at you.
How long did you play pro football? You played with Los Angeles and other teams, and you were Rookie of the Year for the Los Angeles Dons. Is that the nickname?
Well, my first year was with Brooklyn. That's when I got my honors. I was with them, and that was the year I was the Rookie of the Year, and I was on the All-Star team, and I was very fortunate to be on a team made up of NFL and All-America Conference football players, and I was the tailback on that team, and I was very proud of that, to be included with the NFL guys, because we were the guys that started the deal to make the money go up. they were bidding for us to play in the new league. Arch Ward, the sports editor of the Chicago Tribune, was the guy that started the league, and he picked me for some reason. And then when I played in the All-Star game, why, he wanted me to be the number one choice, draft choice of the new league. So that caused the money riot to go up. Sammy Ball and Sid Luckman, whom I played against in the All-Star game also, told me that they were to get $8,500 the year after they won the World Championship in pro football. And they said, they'll play you like a fish and don't go for it. They both told me to ask for three times more money than they made. And then he said, Sammy laughed. He said, then hit them for a bonus of about half that much and see what happens. Well, it worked out real good. I was the number one draft choice, and we weren't in a hurry to go anywhere, so I just told them that this was what I was told to ask for, and I later got it. And then when I got through playing with Brooklyn, they traded me to Los Angeles. This was a manpower shift, and they moved eight players. I went to Los Angeles, and then seven other players went to different people, all financed by the owner of the Los Angeles franchise and Mr. Lindheimer, who owned racetracks and movies and stuff in Florida and Chicago, great real estate man in Chicago. So he was refinancing the whole league by about four teams he personally financed, and they moved some players around, and I wound up with the Los Angeles Dons. We had four All-American tailbacks, and I averaged 53 minutes a game, and those other guys got paid for sitting on the bench. But we played everybody pretty well until about the middle of the third quarter, and both teams in pro ball that I played with in the United States had real good first teams, but we did not have the reserve strength. And so we didn't do as well record-wise as I would have liked. Then I went to be the backfield coach and quarterback with the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. And this was just like playing high school football all over again. A small town. We were the Green Bay of Canadian football. We really enjoyed it, and the people loved it. They loved it, and I showed you my ring that they sent me about a year ago, telling me that I was on their Plaza of Honor up there, and we won the West my first year up there as quarterback and backfield coach. We won the West and got to play in the Grey Cup Bowl game, and we lost that by about 13-7, as I remember, to Ottawa. And the people, you'd have thought we'd have won the Super Bowl and everything else. When we got home, there was a building that held about 8,000 or 10,000 people, just jam-packed around 11 o'clock at night out there to say hello to the guys that got beat in the Grey Cup. I really enjoyed that playing in Canada.
When did you come back to Tulsa?
When?
To the city of Tulsa.
I came back after the 53 season, and I had bought some land down by Mounds, Oklahoma, and I laid out that 1 year and started putting my farm together. So that would have been about 1953 or four. And, I laid out the 54 season. So my last year of football was 53. And then Bobby and I came on the scene at Tulsa University in 1955.
Now, of course, Bobby is your brother, Bobby Dobbs, that played at TU, and he came in 55 as the head football coach, and you came as the athletic director.
Yes, they had come down to the farm, Dan Holmes and Mr. F.E. Stanley came down to the farm one day about middle of the afternoon and wanted me to come and take the Tulsa University football team on a Wednesday. And I said, what? And they wanted me to become the coach. And I said, well, I haven't studied to be a coach, and I don't know anything about it. Why don't you get my brother, who's the assistant head coach of Army, to be your football coach and see about that? So that's the way they went, and Bobby came, and the day after they signed him, they asked me to be the athletic director, And I asked Bobby how he'd feel about that. He said, that'll be fine because I don't have time to do the other stuff, and raising the money in a private school is a big thing, and you're going to have to do that. So we went together, and I was very happy to do so, and I lived on the farm, and that didn't last long. After the first year, we moved to Tulsa and got involved in the football again and with the University of Tulsa.
Well, Coach Bobby Dobbs, in the 50s, late 50s, TU had some tough times, but under Bobby Dobbs, they were 7-2-1 in 56, and then turned around in 58 and were 7-3 and represented the school very well. And then he played or coached TU in, up through 1960. And then your brother left TU in 1960, and you were named head coach. How did that come about, you being named head coach in 61?
Oh, again, the conservative nature of the Tulsa people and the my desire, you always think you can help turn your home team around and your alma mater around. You just want to do it. And even though Bobby had done pretty well here at Tulsa and got a job as a head football coach at Calgary in the Professional League in Canada, he left here because he said that the facilities were not enough and the amount of money for recruiting was not enough, and he was just going to have to move on because he was a career coach. I was not a career coach. I learned how and what little I knew about coaching from my brother. Normal coaching, I will say, because I still don't think much about my ability as a football coach. I was in show business as far as that was concerned, and the idea of getting people out to the ballpark, and then I did not want, like my brother, to have to get people to get me in the game in the middle of the fourth quarter and then try to beat them with conditioning and things that I didn't have, that power and manpower to stay in a ball game for four full quarters with OU and Arkansas and the Southwest Conference so dominant in those days. I just didn't want to mess with that, so I got involved with them, and I told them, I said, I have not studied to be a coach, but I will give her a whirl, and away we went. And I knew that I would have to do it differently, and having had success throwing the football, not just at Tulsa and in Frederick High School, but in the service and in professional football. And I had the greatest teacher in the world about pass protection in Coach Henry Franca, and also the perfection of running pass patterns. And it just seemed natural to me that instead of having a running attack, which I did not have the manpower for, I'd get me some big guys. And like Baby Joe Brooks was a 240-odd pounder football player, and he said, well, Coach, I don't know anything about pass protection. And I said, well, Joe, you're so big. And he said, yeah, but I'm not fast. I said, lay down, they'll have to go around you. And we used that approach, that if they couldn't do a certain way, they'd do another way. But the idea was to protect the passer. That was first. Then the running game came after that, and we utilized that to simply throw them off base a little bit with the fullback draw. And the theory of that fullback draw is different. I do not see anybody today running fullback draw as well as we did or as often as we did. And Bill Goods, I guess we must have gotten him to the safety man 15 or 20 times that year, and he hasn't scored yet. But he ran over the safety man and got tackled there. But we had a way to run the fullback draw that other people to this day don't run it, and very happy and proud that those kids could do it so well. They did well.
Well, we move now to the mid-60s, and you're recruiting players, and you've had some very good teams at TU, but nothing really, press-wise, outstanding.